listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have actor, writer, extraordinaire, Behzad Dabbouh. Did I say that correct?
You did. You said it perfectly.
Dude, I'm a natural, bro. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Of course, dude. I've been excited about this for a while, dude. And thanks for, you know, we're pre-recording this a little bit early today. So you can see the sun coming through your room, at least. My curtains are drawn, but I love it. Natural light. That's all what it's all about, man.
Natural light. I got the mountains I can see over here and a busy street as well. So it's very LA. Mountains. And
you're right in the mix, man. So you grew up in Chicago, right?
No, actually. I grew up in upstate New York.
What? I didn't know this.
But I went to school in Chicago for college.
At Columbia.
And then I stayed there for 10 years. So I kind of have like adopted Chicago as a second home. But I grew up in upstate New York.
What city in upstate?
Real upstate, because New Yorkers think like Yonkers is upstate or like Poughkeepsie is upstate.
No, like Schenectady is pretty upstate. Albany, right?
More.
All right. So what's the name of the city?
Syracuse.
Okay. Oh, that's not, I mean, that's pretty north, but that's a pretty big city. Syracuse is a pretty big city.
It's all right.
Well, I've toured all over. I've done a lot of the SUNY schools.
I've seen parts of
New York State that a lot of New Yorkers have not. And man, it's a beautiful state. Like most people think of New York, when they think of New York, you know what I mean? Yeah. But man, New York, the state, has some beautiful parts. You must have thought it was a little too quiet for what you love now, right? Oh.
You know, it's interesting. The nature in my area was beautiful, like the Finger Lakes right there, and there's
amazing
where. But I guess the urban part where I lived wasn't so beautiful. A lot of boarded up windows and stuff where I grew up. So that's kind of where like my childhood feels a little different than the beauty. But when I've gone back as an adult and visited, that's when I was able to be like, whoa, the colors, the trees, the leaves, like the lakes.
And you know the leaves, man.
Yeah, but I didn't appreciate that as a kid. It wasn't until I went back as an adult that I realized how beautiful the area was.
Well, you must always be rooting for Syracuse when they're playing in the March Madness, I'm sure, right?
Yes, the Syracuse Orange. I grew up, one of my best friends growing up played for the Orange Men. One of the legends, Andy Routon. So I went to a lot of Syracuse games I don't follow college basketball as much anymore, but I was definitely an Orange fan.
Well, you know what's funny? I don't follow it during the season, but March Madness, I'm in, man. Even if I'm not paying attention, I'm betting on it. I'm like watching games. I'm watching the upsets. But Syracuse always. I'm sure that's what a lot of people think of when they think of Syracuse. But tell me what it was like growing up in that environment, and what was the moment of zen that made you first fall in love with movies, acting, writing? What was that moment for you?
I was always a storyteller. I always loved to like tell stories and things. And one time I was very, very young. I vaguely remember this, but I've heard this from other people in my life many times. But I came home one day and I told the biggest lie ever. It was the biggest and most dramatic lie. And all the adults knew right away that I was lying.
Wow.
So I basically was like, I got beat up by a bunch of guys but it didn't make sense because like they didn't take anything. I wasn't bruised and like, you know, and I was telling the story and my mom was like, are you just telling a story? And I was very young. I mean, I was like in kindergarten. And my mom was like, are you just telling a story? And I was like, and then acting classes. And so she put, so I have these pictures of me in these, like, it was called Royal Fairy Tale Theater. And it was all these little kids doing like fairy tale plays and in a park. And then that led to school plays. And then school plays led to me like being good at the thing. And then like putting work into it. Did like community theater. So I would be doing community theater in the summer and I would be doing school plays, you know, during the school year. And then that led to me going to like sort of the camps at Syracuse University. So I enrolled in some Syracuse University theater camps. And then that led to some bigger things and some bigger things so that I knew by 10th, 11th grade that I was going to like, you know, study acting at a BFA program somewhere in America. And very quickly, I found out about Columbia College Chicago and kind of fell in love.
And what did you, do you remember what you did for your audition? Did you have to do like Shakespeare monologues? Like, how did you, you had to probably do something classic and then something kind of modern, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. So I had to do four monologues. I did a dramatic Shakespeare, a comedic Shakespeare, a light contemporary, and like a heavy contemporary, what they call a dark contemporary. So I did four
Shakespeare, what Shakespeare did you do?
Oh my God, I did Hamlet. I did a piece from Hamlet, and I did a piece from Twelfth Night. Sebastian in Twelfth Night, Hamlet in Hamlet, Act 4, Scene 4, right before intermission. And then for the contemporaries, I have no idea what I did for the contemporaries.
It's probably something obscure that your theater teacher was like, you should do this, man. This, and you're like, I'll do this once and never again.
It's so funny because, like, you know, in high school, your theater teachers are like an English teacher who is volunteering. You know what I mean? And she was great. But, you know, you learn a lot. I learned a lot. I would watch. I had the box set from the library. This is before streaming. I had the box set in the library of Inside the Actor's Studio.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow. I watched
every single interview from the beginning of Inside the Actor's Studio until 2004, which is the year it was. I watched every single interview. I learned a lot that way.
Wow.
I was doing community theater. I was reading. I was, you know, Facebook had just become a thing. It was year one of Facebook.
Well, let me ask you first. I've watched a lot of the Inside the Actor's Studios. Do you have a favorite one?
Robin Williams.
Oh, wow. And tell me one.
Robin Williams. It's the only one that I think is 2 hours. The rest of them are an hour.
Because he's a badass. He is such a badass.
He does this bit in the middle of it where a woman in the audience has like a pink scarf and he grabs the pink scarf and he turns it into 15 characters right there live. And you're just watching sort of,
I remember seeing that. Yes. Yes.
Robin Williams is incredible. Duvall's is incredible.
Wow.
Honestly, weirdly, Bradley Cooper's is really inspiring.
I've heard that. And he also was a student and asking questions before that, right? Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
I didn't expect his to be so poignant, but it was. Sean Penn's, there's a lot of great ones. Yeah. And also the women, Meryl Streep, Cate Blanchett, there's some really good ones. Yeah.
Well, I love that became a force for you of inspiration because, man, you're hearing it first person, you know, you're seeing them doing something that is dramatic, comedic, has truth source, they're drawing from their inspirations. So you were captivated by this at a very young age. Were you going to plays as well? Were you watching movies and doing that all at the same time? Were they becoming like just equally as captivating and inspirational forces for you?
1,000%. So my mom and dad, you know, we're South Asian, we're Indian, Zoroastrian.
Right. That's how we know each other, bro. Come on now.
And there's a lot of like, you know, stereotypes about like South Asians not being art families or South Asians, they're pushing you into being doctors and lawyers and architects and stuff. My dad is an architect and my mom worked in, you know, computer software. And so they kind of had those jobs, but and I'm first generation. But what's interesting is, and I thank them for this every day, they were very, very, very supportive of me in the arts. So we were doing, my mom was completely supportive of me doing community theater and taking me to plays and supporting plays. My dad was driving me to rehearsals after school, picking me up late, driving me to the next rehearsal, picking me up late. Like my dad was very supportive of that. And then when I was in the play, you know, I don't have that story of like, oh, I was looking out in the audience for my parents. My parents were like front row, like, you know what I mean? Clapping along. So my parents gave me full support. Not only that, like I remember I did a production of West Side Story back in the day. This was, you know, this is 2005 when Brown was Brown. I know 2024, I wouldn't be cast in West Side Story and I wouldn't audition for it. But in 2005, Brown was Brown. And I was in a production of West Side Story. My mom came to like 20 performances of that thing.
Wow, that's amazing.
All the other cast members like loved her. She became like a second mom. And, you know, my mom also, now that the kids are gone, she is acting in those same theaters. She's acting in the community theaters. My dad is an architect designing sets for those things. Like my mom and dad have like won awards in Syracuse for like theater stuff. So they've really become a part of the community, even though me and my brother are gone now.
Well, what's cool about that, and like my family was also very big on the arts. They were taking us to plays. They were taking us to operas. They were taking us to all kinds of movies, you know, anything you can imagine that was artistic and creative, whether it was a museum or something artistic, that was a big part of it. And I always thought maybe that was because like they grew up, you know, in a communal kind of school and neighborhood where they were putting on plays in their backyards. They were like very much active in the community like that. They don't do that for careers, but they were always wanting my brother and I to just be around that. And they gave us this wealth of experience. So I assume that your parents grew up in a very similar background where they were probably also engaging in a lot of artistic stuff and being around it. And they wanted you guys all to have it, correct?
Absolutely. My mom, so the Zoroastrians in India are called Parsis. And there is a group of Parsi theater people. My mom's parents, so my grandparents, my mom's mom and dad, started a Parsi theater troupe and for like 50 years have been doing Parsi theater all throughout India. Mm-hmm. You know, they've won the Padma Shri Award and there've been books written about them. So yeah, my mom grew up doing plays, rehearsing in their living room. And then my mom won a Shakespeare elocution competition in her high school in India.
So wait, like, isn't Freddie Mercury also Parsi? He's also Parsi.
Yeah,
his name is Bulsara. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
You know what's funny? When Freddie Mercury was alive, and you know, possibly gay, doing drugs, being a rock star, and by say possibly gay, I mean for the Indians at the time, the Parsis wanted nothing to do with him.
Really?
They were like, he's not us. He's not us. And then, of course, he got like knighted by the queen, became world famous, did the huge thing, And then when he died, there was actually a battle. No, he should be buried in Bombay, like where he's, you know, where he's up at the Parsi cemetery. And I'm like, wait, y'all didn't like
That's
him
crazy.
when he was gay. Y'all didn't like him when he was doing drugs, but y'all like him now that he's famous. And
that, you know what? There's something about like how groups, I'll say all groups, it could be ethnic groups, religious groups, doesn't matter what it is, how they attach themselves conveniently. And it's never at the, it's not at the point that the artist needs the most support. It's usually at the point where they're like, we don't really need you. And now they're like, we want you to be a part of this, which is crazy. But I always was very proud that he came from our heritage because I think it's, you know, especially growing up as a kid, Ravi Shankar was the only Indian musician. So to see somebody doing rock, did you have anybody, and this is kind of a cool question, I wasn't expecting to ask you this, did you have any actor that was brown that you were like, oh, I'm drawing inspiration for him, this is like a role model? Did you have somebody like that?
No, it didn't exist. I say this a lot in interviews and people often, so what ends up happening is someone will ask that question and I'll say it didn't exist. And then often the interviewer goes, well, I mean, there's got to be somebody. And then I go, who?
Right.
So what we had in the 90s when I was growing up, I was born in the late 80s. So in the 90s, when I was growing up watching TV, the only brown character we had was Apu in The Simpsons, voiced by Hank Azaria. And that was a character. Not only was it a character, it was a stereotype. Not only was it a stereotype, it wasn't even a stereotype done by a brown guy.
Right.
And so what did we do? We attached ourselves to black shows because it was the only like non-white thing. So I was watching Martin and Fresh Prince and In Living Color.
And
I was watching Sister, and I was watching Hanging with Mr. Cooper and City Guys, and like I was watching black television because there was so much black television in the 90s. A lot of black families, Family Matters, right? A lot of black families.
Well, also really good TV shows too. Let's preface that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that's where I sort of the sort of otherness that the Black families felt, it was the sort of otherness that I think I was relating to. I tell people this all the time. It's not until you have Aziz Ansari, Mindy Kaling, Hasan Minhaj, Dev Patel, Riz Ahmed. It wasn't until Cal Penn. It wasn't until we get to this generation of brown people that kids growing up had brown people to watch on television.
And I don't know if you feel like this too. You feel like this too. Like, and I voice this a lot. I think I have voices to you. The weird thing that I find is I'm still not overly excited about those being the examples, because I know so many talented Indians that are doing much better work, and they're either funnier or they're better actors and actresses or they're better musicians or whatever. And like, I feel like we're still kind of like not completely accurately showcased, and it's I think we and I have talked about this at coffee too. So tell me how you feel about that. You know, I know it's dicey to have this on a question.
I'll have the conversation. It's not a feeling that you have. It is backed up by stats. The USC Annenberg report is every single year comes out and says that for the percentage of people in America that are from the South Asian diaspora, even if you include Middle Eastern people. So if you say Middle Eastern and Manasseh, right? Middle Eastern, North African, right. South Asian. That includes that whole region. We're talking about Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, the whole Egypt, the whole thing. The representative of our, what our population is versus what we are on television is like ridiculous. We have zero representation.
Yes.
We're still on our firsts. Like, we don't even have like the first Indian to win an Oscar for best actor, or the first this or the first that. Like, we don't even have the firsts yet. And I agree with you. What ends up happening is the studios want safe. And so this is no shade to Riz Ahmed and Dev Patel. I think they're both great and do great things.
Right.
But what ends up happening is the studio will say, oh, we have an Indian character. Can we get Riz Ahmed? Can we get Dev Patel? And they'll be like, no, they're doing this project and that project. Oh, well, then we can't do it. It's like, oh, right. Well, you can create a new Riz Ahmed, a new Dev Patel. You can cast myself in it. And then,
right. You
know, I can't become Riz Ahmed or Dev Patel unless you cast me in something the way you gave Dev Patel Slumdog Millionaire, the way you gave Riz Ahmed The Night Of. You have right. To give them their first big project so that they can blow up. But they don't want to take those risks now. And it helps to be one of three things. It helps to be first. It helps to be British.
Right. Right.
Himesh Patel, Riz Ahmed, Dev Patel. It helps to be British. This industry still.
I think Dev is actually Australian. I believe.
Australian. It helps to be not American.
Right.
Because the industry still has this feeling of like they're better trained, they're better this, they're better that, which they have great training, but I have as much, if not more training. I have a master's from University of East London. I have a BFA from Columbia College Chicago. Like, I'm as trained, and so are many other brown actors, but there's sort of like a stereotype against American actors.
So we're talking about this. This is so potent. It's crazy. Yes. Yeah. No, I go through the same thing with music. It's like, you know, I'll have people make really ignorant statements like, oh, you know, like, are you not into like ragas? And I'm like, yeah, of course. I love all that stuff. Do I want to make that stuff? No, because that's not my truth source. I didn't grow up just jamming to Ravi Shankar every weekend. I was listening to Beatles. I was listening to Queen. I was listening to Dave Matthews Band. I was listening to James Brown, Michael Jackson. That's the stuff that I want to write in that vicinity, because those are the things that inspired me. And people don't know how to relate, like, this is not who represents you. And I'm like, actually it is. It almost represents me more than the Ravi Shankars, because I didn't draw from that. I was listening to those other records. You know what I mean? So I go through the same thing, and it's interesting because I always look, and I love seeing the Mindy Kalings, the Deb Patels, Aziz Ansari, just seeing that they all have opportunities. But I get a little frustrated because I'm like, man, this isn't even the best representation. And the other thing too, it's like all of these people, once they get in, they're not throwing the elevator back down, creating opportunities for others. And I'm like, this is so whack. You're not even top of the heap to me, and you're not even creating opportunities. It serves no purpose. You might as well just fill that with a white person or an Asian person of another, you know, land or another, you know, ethnicity. So,
I want to give them one clarification point. some of them I think are trying to throw the elevator back down. And I think the industry is really stopping it. Like I know, for example, Riz is a supporter of the Pillars Fund, which does great work in Hollywood. And every year he helps fund and bring about 10 films by Muslim filmmakers. He does that every year with his own money and with his platform, of course, with the help of an entire team at Pillars, which we should shout out. But and I know Mindy is starting to do some stuff, and I know that I don't know what Dev does, but I'm sure he does something. So I know that they're trying, but it often feels like we are overlooked as a community. And I agree, you know, something about influences. I want to say this. In Hollywood, actors do a lot of things called generals, which is like a 20-minute meeting you have with a decision maker where they get to know you. And often they're like, well, what is your type? You know, like who is your type? Like, what is an actor you want to model yourself after? And they always want me to say Riz, Dev. Wow. But what's interesting is I'll be like, oh, I'll be like young John Turturro. Or I'll be like John Leguizamo.
Right.
Or I'll be like, John Turturro, young John Leguizamo. I even think about, oh my God, I'm blanking on a name. But anyway, and they'll be like, oh, and they get so confused. And I'm like, but why are you confused? Like my energy is actually very matched to those two actors. The types of roles I do is actually very matched to those two actors. Like, like the sort of like quirky vulnerability, the authentic, like real guy who can sort of like have a little street swag or whatever you want to call it. Like that's John Turturro's roles. That's John Leguizamo's roles. That's where I watched those movies that they were in as a kid and been like, I can do that role. I want to do that role. I can do that play. You know what I mean? And so to see people in Hollywood be like, oh, it's weird. It's like we only see in the binary of color.
I love that you're bringing this up because I think about this on the daily. And I even thought, you know, I was watching Gandhi the other day. And Ben Kingsley, I mean, he rocked that role. But I was just like, wow, they couldn't find an Indian to play this role. Like, I know he's got some blood in there, but it's like,
I think his grandfather is Indian. So he's like 25% or 50%.
Yes, I think it's exactly it. I heard he's a quarter Indian. Yeah. But in a lot of ways, that could be considered blackface, brownface, because of what they did to make him look Indian. And but he killed the role. Sure. He killed the role. You know what I mean? But I'm like, yo, this is crazy. Like they could have, I think he did an amazing job with the role, but like I watched it and I had a very different reaction than when I saw it first in the '80s, you know, and I was like so proud of it in the '80s. And now I was like, he did a great job, but what the hell? Like, this is crazy.
It's hard to judge yesterday's actions by today's standards. And so like back in the day, it wasn't a thing. You know, I think about this a lot. When I was in high school, my senior production, they were like, you can do whatever you want. Like they were like, what do you want to do? And we picked The King and I for the school musical.
That's a good one.
And I played the King of Siam with a bald head and with like all the sort of East Asian clothing.
Right.
The kids in 2024, the high school kids in 2024 are so aware of stuff now that they wouldn't say that. Like an Indian kid in my position at the same high school I went to in upstate New York in 2024 would not say to do The King and I. They would be like, well, that would be appropriation. I'm not from that culture. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do an Asian accent because that's not my people. Like the society today, that's what they talk about. It's what to wear. When I tell you, and I mean this, this is 1000% the truth. Not a single adult or friend brought up a single concern throughout the 6 months process that we did that thing. Wow. Not a single person was like, oh, this is wrong. Not a single, I didn't think it.
Right. It was also a role you probably were like, I can do this role. This is something that would be, make sense. But it's, yes.
And that's what it felt like in 2004. But 20 years later, of course I wouldn't say that now, but like we learn, we grow. Isn't that good? We've learned and we've grown and we've come to a different thing. I would pick a different musical now. I would do a different thing. But at the time it's like, and again, it's not a justification, but it's just like at the time it was correct. And now it is not. So I can't judge that action on today's standard. it's just a, it's a different thing.
What's interesting too, it's like, and I want, this is a question for you as an actor, when you're looking through roles or screenplays or commercials or auditions, what are the roles that you are, oh, this is a, actually a really good question, I think. What are the roles that you are getting and what are the roles you are looking for?
Yeah.
This is a potent question. We're getting to the good stuff right now. Yes.
Yeah. It's a great question because there are definitely two different things, right? The roles I'm getting and the roles I'm looking for are different. I love characters with nuance. So I often say a guy who is outwardly super strong with an inner vulnerability, or the opposite, a guy who is like outwardly super weak with an inner fire. So the inner fire that's going to have to come out through the weakness, or the inner strength or the inner vulnerability that's going to have to come in through the outwardly strong thing. Right. So the sort of like dichotomy there.
You like the conflict. Yeah.
I want to play layers. I want to play the onion. I want to play three things at one time. I want to be able to use my intellect to play multiple things, because that's how humans are. We're complex. What am I getting? Well, you know, a lot of different auditions, but you know, sometimes it's
you're getting terrorist number one, you're getting bomb threat number three.
I used to, but you know, this is actually a good lesson. You teach people how to treat you in this industry.
Right.
So in my early 20s, I did. I got a lot of terrorist number two, bomb guy, you know, come in, say some Allahu Akbar, and then you blow up a thing and it's super offensive and bullshit. But you teach people how to treat you. So I've turned that stuff down within 5 minutes of getting the email now so many times that I actually don't get it anymore, because casting has learned, like, Bezos going to turn this down. My agents have learned, Bezos going to turn this down. My managers have learned, don't even email it to them, because you teach people, hey, I pass on this. And here's the trick. And why? I'm passing on this because I find it offensive that there's no background and all he says is Allahu Akbar and blows up a thing.
Well, and also you get what you settle for. So it's like, if you're like, oh yeah, I'll do that because I want to get work, it's like, now you're going to be getting those roles for the next five projects. And it's like,
exactly. You teach people how to treat you. So then it's like, hey, I'm passing on this because this character is set in Gujarat, but is for some reason speaking Urdu, which they don't speak there. So clearly this writer hasn't done the research. So I'm passing. I'm passing on this role because, you know, there's this, whatever it is. So if you tell them why, you quickly teach people how to treat you. And I think there's a fear as an artist that, like, oh my God, they're going to hate me. No, they're going to respect you. They're going to understand what your line is. They're going to forget about it. They're going to go, okay. But pretty soon it's like, so actually I don't get the offensive stuff anymore. But
that's cool. That's good. You set a standard.
Riz Ahmed talks about something in a Guardian article. I wish I could find the, I'm sure I could. If you type in Riz Ahmed, The Guardian from a few years back, he talks about the three levels of, as a brown artist, what happens. So, and it's not just for Indian, it's for any minority. The first level is the offensive stereotype. So for me, that's the terrorist. For maybe a Latino actor, that's like the maid or the super gangster, right? Then the next level is the stereotype, but not the offensive stereotype. So the next level would be nerdy math guy or doctor, right? So it's still a stereotype and it's not nuanced, but it's not the offensive stereotype. For the, you know, for the Latino at that point, that might be the Uber driver. For the black person, it might go from like, you're playing like slave trauma stuff, but then you're going into maybe the character who's learning how to read, right? It's the stereotype, but it's not as offensive as the first stereotype. And then that third level is that you get to play nuanced, well-written, fully thorough characters that have an emotional journey and an arc, right? Where you're not just, where it's a character written about a human and not a person who fills a color quota. So that's interesting. So now what's cool about my career is I'm getting a little bit of both of those, right? I've had the privilege and the honor to be playing things that are fully nuanced characters that do have an arc. I've had 20 episode arcs on shows where it's not about my color and race. But yeah, I do also get auditions for, like, you know, one episode guest star on a network show for a doctor for one episode. And listen, if it's not offensive and it's going to pay some bills, let's do it. But I'm definitely right. have eliminated level three.
Well, that's a relief on one, on some level. I know there are still actors getting those auditions,
of course.
And you set that standard for yourself. But tell me, once you got to Columbia and you're in this environment and you're out of high school and you're like, okay, this is the environment of who I want to be around. Tell me, how was that a continuation of a lot of those same trials, or did you kind of feel it was very kind of avant-garde in the sense of, oh, I could do anything. People don't see it as, you know, typecasting or anything, or any stereotypical casting.
Columbia College Chicago has changed a lot over the 20 years since I've been there. Every single person that was there when I was there is gone, either left or has passed on. But when I was there, it was the most incredible experience. I flipping loved it.
That's awesome.
I was performing. I was playing all types of characters. The teachers just saw me as an artist, as an actor. They developed my skills. Like, they noticed that I would play this type. They put me in this type so I could learn that. They made sure I was well-rounded. They pushed me. They challenged me. They helped me grow. So much of what I teach today in my teaching, I pulled from the mentors and teachers I had there.
That's cool.
There was a different president. There was a different chair. There was different faculty. So it was a totally different school. There was a totally ethos behind the school. What I hear now is that it's very different. But back then, it was amazing. And I learned so much. And I wouldn't change that experience for the world. So, no, they were building. I was doing Italian commedia dell'arte. I was doing British styles. I had a class about African-American playwrights. I did movement and combat and classic theater and contemporary theater. I was doing everything under the sun.
So it was very forward thinking.
Yes, absolutely, at the time. And then also we did Arabian Nights. Like, I also did that. You know what I mean? But it was great. And so I loved that. And then growing up, as soon as I graduated, I dove into the Chicago theater scene. And was doing like a Chicago premiere of The History Boys, which was a British play. And I did Holes, the Louis Sacker book, played Zero, which wasn't about my race, right? So a lot of what we used to call colorblind casting, where it's like, it doesn't matter if I'm Indian or not, I'm just playing this role. And then we've then moved on to color conscious casting, which is like, yeah, if I can play the guy here, I'll play the guy. But also, if you need someone Middle Eastern for this play called Inanna, I'm going to audition for that too, you know? So conscious of it. But no, my college experience was fantastic back in the day. I loved it.
Well, you know, it's funny. I went to USC School of Music and I studied opera. And it was like, it was a lot of kind of what I experienced doing operas and LA opera. It was like, oh, I could do a certain amount of things, but it wasn't like unlimited. But the thing that kind of really opened everything up for me was my songwriting teacher, because he didn't care where you were from, what ethnicity, what color you were, what gender you were, what anything, because he was like, a great song needs to come from truth source and it needs to come from the infinite. And like, he would talk about these things and I'm like, oh my God. And I'm still very close with him because it was not based on anything like that. So it's like, I found classical music super confining and actually very suffocating. And I found songwriting like, oh, I could do any of this, including writing music in the classical genre or operatic influence music. And, you know, which is why Queen was like such a great influence, because they were doing like rock operas, you know? So It's interesting to find that the environment that you were in was so forward thinking. Now you graduate college, and you're in the real world. Did you get a little bit of an eye-opening kind of experience, because it wasn't like that? It was back to being very conventional and like, oh, we're going to keep you in the box because this is what we're used to.
I had this weird experience, and it, you know what? It mirrored itself for my first year in Chicago after college. Mirrored itself again my first year in LA. So that's like a cool cycle. But in both situations, I had a bit of a flip. I jumped right into super success and then had the eye-opening experience. And the same thing happened in LA. I jumped into super success. My first audition in LA was a 20-episode guest star on a hit show.
Wow.
And then Then the show ended, and then I had my eye-opening experience. And the same thing happened in Chicago. So when I graduated college, I immediately jumped into hit show in Chicago, won every award there was, sold out for 7 months, like couldn't get a ticket to this show. One of the best theatrical experiences of my lifelong friends. I'm still best friends with today, people from that cast.
So that's where you met Malzahn, I assume, because she's been a guest as well.
I met Malzahn a year later. But okay. but yeah, this first show I did was called The History Boys, and it was just amazing. And that led to another show at the Goodman Theater, which is the biggest theater in Chicago. And then that led to this other thing and this other thing. And then I was like, oh, this is easy. This is easy. I'm in my early 20s. This is easy. This is going to keep going, right? Why would it stop? And then all of a sudden it stops. And why does it stop? Well, it stops because there's nothing for you that year, or because they cast another guy, or because someone else is hot shit, or whatever. It just stopped for whatever reason, because there's peaks and valleys in the industry. And so it stopped. And then I was like, oh. And everybody else was like, yeah, bro, welcome to the party. You know what I mean?
I was like, it's not too easy now.
Yeah, exactly. So then I had a rough couple years, but it really taught me. I'm glad I had that, because it really taught me about the peaks and valleys of this industry. And so then I met Malzahn. We did a great play together. Then I had to struggle and did this amazing play that changed the course of my life, which we can talk about later. Literally changed the course of my entire life, this play. But the same thing happened in LA. Like, I got to LA 10 years later, and I'm doing this play, and boom, get this first audition, boom, book it, boom, have this amazing year and a half doing the show. Then that ends, and it's like, now what? And then it was a rough year and a half of trying to find reps and trying to figure out where to live.
Do you attribute that to, like, who holds the keys in Hollywood? Because I always notice that it's like, you know, I was actually having a conversation with somebody about this. You know, it's like I knew right away I wasn't going to have an agent, a label, a manager that was high powered. So I ended up just representing myself, creating a label, doing everything on my own. And it's like now we're working with the biggest promoters. We're working like we have like fit into this really cool market that we've kind of like, you know, etched out of like a place for ourselves. And now my friends that are on agents and, you know, that have managers and things, they're like a little bit frustrated. I'm like, no, it's like, I didn't wait. I went for the, okay, I'm going to go create this opportunity for myself. But I kind of saw the writing on the wall right away. It was like, oh, okay, this is not going to be something where I'm going to get an agent, like the person next to me that got an agent, was signed to a label, and now they're not doing anything. But I saw so many people getting these opportunities signed to agencies, and it was like, okay, I know that's not going to be my path, so I better prepare for, you know, sink or swim. And I swim, you know, like, and it's like, that's a result of that. But did you find that it was like, there was a challenge with who holds the keys, how they hold them, how many brown people they're signing to rosters or casting or whatever? Tell me what that experience was like.
No. There used to be a world in the 90s where you could rep yourself. They wouldn't know. All like emails. Yes. But you know, now you can't. Literally, they have gate kept it so well that like only agents get access to the breakdowns, and those agents have to be like franchised. So only agents get access to breakdowns. So if you want to rep yourself, you might be all day spending on the computer, but you literally don't have access. You don't have access to the casting director's phones. You don't have access to the emails. You don't have access to do it. And then like your manager stuff. So they've made it a world which you need a team. And I'm lucky. I have a great manager at a great management firm. And I've been through lots of agents over 7 years in LA.
Right. I'm sure.
I've been with the biggest company in LA. I've been in the world. I've been with the third biggest company. I've been with the sixth biggest company. I've been with all those. I'm also currently right now, I've been with small boutique agencies. I've been run through the gamut with agents. And right now I have an agent I've had for about a year and some change. A lot of that has been the strike. But you know, it's an agent that's like a little mix of both. A guy who's come from a big company, but now who has his own small company. So it's a little bit mix of both. Yes, there is gatekeeping. Yes, there are doors closed. Yes, there is who holds the keys. Yes, there is system. Yes, there's so much that you have to navigate. But for me, we've talked about this. For me, I treat the business with as much craft and as much thought and as much discipline as I do the craft. So for me, So for me, it's like, I am going to go to that screening and meet that director, and not in a thirsty, opportunistic way, but in actually build a relationship way. And right. That's the thing that I think people miss. They have made networking ugly because they're only networking for an opportunistic thing. Like, oh, I want to go to this event so I can meet that person, so that person can cast me. But what if you just go to that event to meet that person to vibe?
Right. Right.
That person work because you really like it. That way it doesn't feel ugly and thirsty and transactional and really just feels like we're building something. You know, it's interesting. Like, even the way, part of the reason why you and I met at an event is because we were just talking. I wasn't talking to you to get something out of you. I was just talking to you.
Well, you also came from a place where we were talking music, and like you love a lot of the same music that I love. We started talking about funk, and I was like, oh, I already know I'm going to be homies with this guy for a long time. Yeah. But it is that community thing where it's like, oh, we're hanging. Like, it's not, I don't need to give you anything. You don't need to give me anything. Yeah. And there's something there. It's really interesting. Yeah.
That's a good example. I'm not a musician. I was talking about music because we were talking about music. And what's crazy is a lot of times what happens in a networking opportunity is if I wasn't thinking of you that way, what would happen is I'd be like, oh, what do you do? Do you know someone? Oh, you're a musician. Oh, you can't help me? Bye.
Right. That's good. You're very like big about this. You're not self-serving. You think about much bigger things. And it is about like gaining kind of like camaraderie and a vibe and a connection with people. And then, you know that it's like, I already know like what's so crazy. I already know you're a badass artist and you've got a lot of accomplishments too. But just from the way you talk about art, the way you talk about music, the way you talk about everything. And real quick, just so people don't think you're just like, you know, not as accomplished as you are, just list off some of the things that you've done as far as plays, TV shows, so people know and they're aware. Just go through like a quick like bullet point.
Well, all right, I'll try to do this quick. I've worked at the best theaters in the country, from Goodman to Steppenwolf to La Jolla to Center Theater Group, Berkeley Rep, Seattle Rep. I've worked with the best theaters in the country. I've
all big names.
Say that again.
All big names. Yeah.
I've originated plays with Pulitzer Prize winning playwrights. So I was in the original production of Disgraced. I think I've done more productions of Disgraced than any human all over the country. I'm doing another one actually coming up in a couple months, a reading in Studio City. And then on television, you know, I've worked on network cable. I'm the acting coach for The Shy. I am the director of acting for the Hillman Grad Lab, which is Lena Waithe's company. I run a scene study at the Last Acting Studio. I'm an actor who does a lot of TV. Yeah.
Name some of the TV stuff too. So people are like, oh, I love that show. Or, you know what I mean?
I did a large arc on How to Get Away with Murder, a large arc on The Shy on Showtime, The Good Place.
That must have been a great, How to Get Away with Murder was an amazing cast. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
It was grad school for me. I always call it like it was television grad school. So it was a great lesson in how to stick around. I don't think people realize this, but when you do a multiple episode guest star arc, and what I mean by guest star is a guest star is a person that's not in every episode with a guaranteed contract. So the main cast of any show that you see, those are called series regulars. So those have like a guaranteed contract for a year or two or three or four or five or six or seven. But as a guest star, I think what people don't realize is it's one contract at a time. You can, I ended up doing 20 episodes, but you don't get a 20 episode contract. You get one at a time. So every time could be your last time. You have to maintain it. You have to keep getting a new offer. So you have to maintain it. So for me, it was a lesson I observed and I watched and I learned. What is the name of the guy who's doing this? What is the name of the guy who does this? What is the name of the lady who's doing this? What is the name of the person who's doing that? And like really figuring it out so that I could get more and more confident. And by the second season I was on it, I was like, okay, cool. Now I can start focusing on some craft stuff. Like, oh, I can notice that the camera is there. And when it crosses this person's head, they actually take a breath and pause. Let me try that. And because by then I had the comfort to not just worry about getting my part right. I was like, oh, I can play a little bit. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that's a musician type thing. Like the first couple rehearsals with a new band, you might be like, let me come in on time. Let me not miss my entrance. Let me like make sure I'm not playing too loud. Let me not. But then after
you're a like, little oh, bit, let me play. Let me like, yeah.
Then yeah. I was like, oh, I know that bass player. Let me right. rock with this. Let me fuck with like some volume. Let me see what happens if I, you know, during that sick that time change, what if I hit the cymbal right before it? You know what I mean? Like right, whatever right, it is. Right. And so I started to play and learned a lot. And so for me, I took it as education.
That's a testament to you as an artist too. Like you're thinking like an artist when you're doing that. It's like, you know, when you're there for a gig and you know, when you're there to stretch and like flex a little bit, but like do it in a way where it's like everybody's flexing around and you now are playing together. You're like, now it's bigger than just a singular expression. It's like, this has become like an ensemble. It's become a group expression. And then you all move together. It's like, I love ensemble casts like that. And you know, that show that you were on, it really is an ensemble cast. Absolutely. You know, very much like what the modern, like The Bear or like mm-hmm. the shows are now. You know what I mean? Like, they're starting to see that ensemble casts are very valuable. Like, people don't underestimate how important that is when you see a group of people doing it together and doing it well. So let's talk about this. We're running a little bit out of time, but I wanted to talk about that play that was like a monumental experience for you. Tell me about that.
I just want to say Viola Davis on How Your Murder. Also, I recognize that like she's a GOAT and will be, right? Yeah. So for me, I'm like, oh, this is like a basketball player getting a chance to play with LeBron, Kobe, MJ. Like,
right.
I'm not going to just like piss away this experience. And I don't mean that of like networking again. I mean that of like watching, learning, you know, and I did. Like I watched and learned and picked up a lot of stuff because I'm like, a lot of people will spend their whole careers and not get a chance to play with LeBron or Kobe or MJ or KD or whoever the GOATs are. And I'm like, this is a living GOAT right now. So I'm going to do that. Okay. The play I did was called Disgraced. It did win the Pulitzer Prize in 2013. I worked on it in 2012 in the original production, developed it, and it did it all over the country. But that play is what actually brought me to LA, and doing that play is what got me How to Get Away with Murder. And that play had sort of highs and lows in my career of productions I got, productions I didn't get, contracts I liked, contracts I didn't like, experiences I liked, experiences I didn't like. But weathering that, going through that, it is the thing I think that I'm most proud of. It's like the accomplishment, the artistic accomplishment in my life that I'm most proud of that led me to exactly where I am today. Like if I didn't go through that like shitty experience with this play in 2015, then I wouldn't be here today in 2024. And working on new plays and new artists, and people say like, what's your dream role? And I often say it hasn't been written yet. Someone's going to write it in 2032. I'm going to get cast in 2033. We're going to shoot it in 2034.
Yes.
And come out in 2035. And that's going to be my dream role. I don't know.
Well, you're savoring the experience. I mean, that's the thing about art. It's like you have to savor the now and look forward to what's ahead. And like, you know, it's kind of like I've heard a lot of artists, and especially actors, say this. It's like they're just like, you know, it's like a slow burn. You know, it's like when you kind of like learn the craft, you realize everything is a slow burn to these really beautiful peaks that you're like, oh, I was doing all this other stuff for 10, 15 years to do this one role. I was learning all of these, you know, roles and, you know, period pieces or like ways to attack the craft for this role. And it's like, I'm in a place right now where I'm doing that with this show that I'm building. I'm like, I could not have done this show that I'm directing, producing, and doing all the music for, which is a music show, it's a music series. I couldn't have done this 5 years ago. I couldn't even have done it 10 years ago because of where I'm at musically. It took me so long to get to that point to be able to play guitar solos, to be able to like, you know, understand cameras and understand music and producing all those things. But it's like, those are the things we work towards. It's like, I can't wait to see like what's next for you because you're already in that slow burning process where it's like, everything's brimming. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's just like marinating in whatever it is. Where can casting agents, directors, where can people find you if they want to cast you in something? Where are you online?
On my Instagram, it's just my name, at BEHZADDABU. My website also, bezadabu.com. There's a contact page there. You can get to my reps. You can get to me. You can get to my assistants. You can get to everybody you need to get to. And yeah, so my website and my Instagram is an easy place to find me.
I love it. I love it. Behzad, you've been a wonderful guest. We're going to have you come back in about 9 or 10 months because I know you're always stirring pots. And I just find you to be a fascinating artist and a great friend, too. We've become very tight in a very short amount of time. And that's because you're a badass artist. So we're going to have you back in 9 or 10 months. But, dude, thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. And we look forward to seeing many more things. We're going to have to collaborate on something for sure. We're going to have to do something. And you have a short with Malzahn. You have a short with Malzahn that's going to be out soon. What is the tentative date that you think it'll be released?
That's called Maggie's Not Okay. But the first thing we're going to do is we're going to do film festivals. So it has to be submitted to film festivals first. And then after the festival circuit, it'll have a public facing thing. But hopefully it premieres at one of these festivals and that'll be the place to see it. That hasn't happened yet, but it will.
Well, I'm going to help you with there's a festival in Portugal that you have to get into. I'm going to text you the information. Because it's amazing, and there are Oscar winners going to it, and we'll have to talk. So we'll talk off screen, but great. On behalf of everybody, on behalf of Behzad, myself, and Sam, tune in next week. We'll see you guys. Take care. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence. Right here on LA Talk Radio.